Hi, everyone. I'm Raj Kumar, President and Editor-in-Chief of DevEx. This week, we'll be breaking down the big headlines in global development and bringing in some top experts to help us do it. If you want to follow along with the stories we're talking about, check out devx.com and subscribe to our daily newsletter, The Newswire. There's a link in the description. Follow us along on Twitter, and you can see many of the stories we're talking about today. And we'd love to hear what you think. This is This Week in Global Development.
But I'm joined by two great guests, my own colleague, Advas Aldinger. Hey, Advas.
Hi, Raj. Great to be with you today.
Yeah, nice to be with you, too. Advas, of course, a senior reporter here at DevEx. And we're also joined by Bijan Nashat. Hi, Bijan.
Hi.
Good to hear your voice, Bijan. Bijan is the managing director at Equitas Human Capital. You probably, many of you know him as the former CEO of Atlas Corps. He was on the executive team at Save the Children, and he worked at the World Bank. So lots of relevant experience for the discussion we're going to have today. And yeah, Val, like so many stories this week, but maybe we can just start with a couple that are up your alley related to finance. We had our colleague Anthony Lingat, who's based in Nairobi, cover a couple of big stories related to IDA and related to the creation of a new Africa-focused debtor country conglomerate coalition called the Africa Club. I'd love to hear a little bit more about those stories from you.
Absolutely. Maybe we'll start with this meeting about IDA. So just so it's clear to everyone, IDA is the World Bank's fund for the world's poorest countries. There are 75 IDA countries, and it provides highly concessional or grant-based capital to those countries. And I actually had an opportunity to dive into IDA for a special edition podcast episode we did around the World Bank meetings. And one of the things that stood out from those conversations was what Malawi's Ambassador Chombo, she's their ambassador to the US, told me. And she essentially said that without IDA, Malawi will perish. And I think that that gives you a sense of sort of the gravity with which a lot of African countries look at this IDA replenishment and just what's at stake for a lot of these countries. And what we saw out of the meeting was that they want to see a focus on things like human capital and job creation, energy and digital access, and building resilience to climate and fragility. They want the World Bank to support policies around inclusive growth and debt management and boosting, you know, domestic and foreign investment. But they also want IDA to be less complex and easier to access and more flexible. And one of the things they're calling for is that they want IDA to deliver $120 billion over this next replenishment period. It'll be a three-year cycle. In 2021, which was the last IDA replenishment, the total amount of money that the World Bank was able to sort of commit to spending in the three-year period was $93 billion. So that was about $23.5 billion that shareholders put up, and the rest they're able to get about a 3.5 to 1 leverage ratio by going to the capital markets and by, you know, other fees and things that IBRD and other parts of the World Bank are contributing to IDA. So this year, what Ajay Banga has said and what we heard echoed at this meeting is really a call for shareholders to step up and provide somewhere between $28 and $30 billion of capital in this replenishment cycle to be able to hit that $120 billion mark. The World Bank says that would allow it to hit around $100 billion. So I think there's going to be, you know, some interesting discussions about how you get to all these numbers. But it was interesting to sort of see how those discussions played out. And I think a part of it that's important is that, you know, you mentioned this new Africa Club, and there was also this sort of call for broader reform to the global financial architecture at the meeting this week. And I think that's what the Africa Club comes out of. And I think the basic baseline is that African countries, more than half of African countries today, are spending more on debt repayment than on things like healthcare and climate change and education. We've seen three African countries default on their debt, and the current system for managing debt, either in those countries that have defaulted or who are in distress, is not working. I think there's general acknowledgement and understanding around that. And so this new Africa Club, I think we'll see what comes out of it. It's a group that sort of coalition of African financial institutions like the Africa Finance Corporation, Afrexim, the Trade and Development Bank, that are going to push for reforms to the global financial architecture. I think when I first heard of it, I was like, are they trying to be the Paris Club? But the Paris Club is, you know, a group of debtors that came together traditionally to work out debt deals. That's not who this organization is. I think they're going to try to push for a greater voice of African nations in these discussions around the global financial architecture. We've seen that in recent years as a key priority for leaders on the continent. The AU has been given a seat at the G20, which I think moves towards that. We've seen, you know, the UN vote to have discussions and be sort of a place for debate and regulation setting around the global tax architecture, which is something African nations have really pushed for. And there's discussions underway there actually right now. And also we'll see sort of in the lead up and then certainly next year in Spain at the Financing for Development Conference, how some of those discussions emerge. And we've also seen on the continent, you know, a push for an African Central Bank, an African Monetary Fund. There hasn't been that much progress on some of those initiatives. And I think, you know, with this Africa Club, we even heard from some of the experts that there's questions about whether it will deliver, right? Is it more than an MOU? Is it a, you know, a distraction? Or are they focused on the right things? So I think we'll see how that all plays out. But there's certainly, I think, a lot going on. And I'll just mention one last thing, which I think will be interesting to our audience, which is the launch of an IDA 21 coalition, which is civil society foundations and the private sector coming together to advocate around the replenishment. We're seeing sort of a very different atmosphere around advocacy around the replenishment, the likes of the Gates Foundation sort of putting in money and time and effort in a way that they haven't in past cycles. I think in response to the realization, one of the, you know, IDA has always been important, but particularly important now when these countries are not having a lot of money coming in, but also because of the challenging fiscal and political environments in a lot of the donor nations and trying to find a pathway to, you know, coming up with this money, I think will be a challenge this year.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the macro or meta story here. And Bijan, I love your thoughts about it too. You know, there's sort of like two narratives. If you're in the US, if you're in Europe, you know, the traditional donor countries, the politics are moving in the opposite direction, right? The parliamentary elections in the EU look like they're moving rightward. In the US, you see that the polls are generally sort of tied or even have, you know, former President Trump leading in the US elections. And DevEx, we've been doing a lot of coverage of what a Trump administration would mean for the funding levels and the aid architecture. So you see sort of these narratives in the US and in Europe that are quite at the opposite end of what you're hearing from African leaders who are saying, actually, this is a moment of real crisis for us, and you need to be paying more attention to our fiscal situation. We are, you know, teetering on the edge here. And at this moment when the politics are not in favor of big increases in aid, you have multiple organizations out there looking for replenishments, IDA being one of the most important, but many others. And so there's a sense of a zero-sum game in the global north, while at the same time in the global south, African leaders are saying, hang on a second, you're sort of missing the big picture, not just asking for more money, but asking actually for reform. So I think it's a fascinating dynamic that we're in. Bijan, I'd love to get your thoughts about this broad story.
Absolutely agree. And by the way, great reporting. I really enjoy diving into these stories. So how can you not be in favor of asking for stronger human capital and the creation of good jobs on the one hand? And then I was reminded of Charles Kenny's argument, right? Don't make it about numbers only, especially if it makes you borrow against the future in the current interest rate environment. So I've been part of so many of these conversations over the last decades where people have incentives to make it about big numbers, where actually it should be more focused on what's really impactful for the future, both in terms of the outcomes of this, and then that we don't squander opportunities to leverage later on.
Quick on that, Bijan, you know, part of the reporting shows, and Bob mentioned it briefly, that the One Campaign and others have been showing that there's actually very little net financial flows, maybe even negative, depending on how you do the math, going into low and middle income countries because of the amount of debt repayments that are coming out of low and middle income countries. So it's fascinating that if you don't look at the numbers, if you don't try to get this big, bold, whatever it is, $120 billion number, we might continue in the situation where the financial flows are net going out of these countries. On the other hand, the reason they are net going out of these countries is what you just said, that years ago, the debts were taken on including by the MDBs, and maybe for projects that didn't actually achieve their objectives.
The fact that the debt conversations are now front and center again are really interesting for this. So what I see in these articles and more broadly is that some of the conversation is changing. For example, in your article, if you listen to the language of the Kenyan president, Ruto, I quote, "We decided in Nairobi that we are not going to take the corner of the victim and try to point fingers and play the blame game. We are going to do something about it and be part of the solution." As one example, I think language matters and how people position themselves, knowing about the conversations both in Europe and in the US. And then Mavis, my friend and former Save the Children colleague, who is also quoted in the article, thinking about new ways of framing this, right? And she's saying, how can we evaluate Africa's contributions to natural resources and to climate change, given what Africa has given to the world as a provider of natural resource capital? Is it not too much to ask for an increase in fair share of allocation? So new ways of framing this, also given the World Bank's new mission, I think are helpful here to change part of the conversation. I would hope so.
Yeah, I think Mavis's point is great. And you're right that especially in an environment that's much more contested in the global north politically, where the old coalitions may not be as strong as they once were, it's really important to find new arguments and new narratives. It can't just be, please continue to fund the things that have lost so much political support.
If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably already working in global development, or maybe you're thinking about carving out a new path in the social impact space. Regardless, we all need a little help sometimes in our pursuit of a happy, fulfilling, and impactful work life. Whether you're actively searching for a new role or looking for some pointers on how to strike a healthier work-life balance. I'm Justin Sablich, DevEx's careers editor, and each Friday in the Career Hub newsletter, I'll bring you inside the minds of leading career coaches and recruiters to help you navigate the next step of your professional journey. You'll also have access to the latest hiring and salary trends and a weekly dose of the best leads from Global Development's largest job board. Visit devx.com/careerhub to subscribe.
I had the opportunity to speak to the head of UNDP, Achim Steiner, right after the G20 meetings that took place alongside of the IMF World Bank spring meetings. And one of the things he said stood out to me, and he said that, you know, G20 nations, wealthy country nations, don't really think that the economies and indebtedness of poor countries have an impact on the global economy. And partly because of that, it hasn't been a priority and there hasn't been a solution. And maybe there isn't the political will that is necessary to sort of really transform these systems to one that works. And I think that that was quite striking and is sort of an added element in this broader sort of political discussion on where do you go from here and how do you solve some of the challenges, because bringing down the debt and those debt repayments is also a way to address the issue around financial flows. But I do think, to your point, borrowing going forward has to be smart borrowing and borrowing that actually leads to growth in a way that countries will have more capital to be able to repay those debts.
And I think Achim's point is probably right. I mean, if you actually talk to the macroeconomists, and I'm actually sitting here at an event at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, where there are a lot of economists and talking about these very issues. And I think he's probably right at this macro level. Given how big the world's largest economies really are and how small many of these low and middle income countries are. However, the story that is really salient is migration. I mean, migration is probably the most important political issue in both the US presidential election and the European parliamentary elections and many national elections in Europe. And so it's directly tied to exactly what these African leaders are talking about and their ability to create economic growth and jobs and a future for their population, so people do not feel the need to flee, whether it's conflict or climate change or violence and corruption. You know, people are fleeing and they're kind of voting with their feet. So in some ways, these issues are really front and center in global politics in a way they haven't been before, precisely because of the migration question, something I think you probably witnessed a lot of, Bijan, when you were with Save the Children in Germany.
Absolutely. It takes me back to the refugee response where hundreds of thousands of Syrian children came to Germany. I think it's also actually, you can see it in the Europe's future development vision piece. And I'd be curious about your take on this. I went to the actual playbook document as well. It's fascinating. You see these contradictions show up there. So for example, right, it points to the importance of remittances, double ODA, right? The projections are in that document with statistics. And then it says, skills and youth employment are the key priorities for African countries in terms of how can we focus better on what our partner countries are interested in. And then at the same time, it says, what we're going to do should stop migration as a key goal, right? And so there's a lot of contradictions here still, even when they're trying to be more strategic. And of course, I know where they come from. They're political. But if we really want to change the way we talk about jobs, if we want to change the way we talk about youth and their opportunities, migration and talent and these conversations have to be part of it.
Yeah, it's a great point. And you're referring, of course, to this draft document that is really the development policy for the European Commission over the next 5 years. And Politico got their hands on this draft and reported on it. And our own colleague, Vince Chadwick, wrote a piece kind of analyzing, well, what's really in it and what does it mean? And as you say, it's this real contradiction. Is on the one hand, the European Commission is trying to be really strategic and they recognize kind of the moment we're in, the moment these African leaders are saying we're in, of real peril and that we have to do something different. And on the other hand, a lot of what they're doing is the same because they face a lot of the political pressures that every donor nation does. And so they end up dividing up the pot of money in lots and lots of little pieces because they sort of have to be everywhere, right? And then what do they do in each place? Well, they do a little bit of everything. And so the quote at the top of the story is that Brussels says it's too often trying to do, quote, everything everywhere all at once, which is, you know, a reference to the film. But it really is sort of true when you read through the lines here. So they kind of get what the problem is. They see the need for the strategy and to be focused, but yet they're falling back into the way the aid system is structured, which is, again, a little bit like another piece we reported this week at USAID and sort of the challenge that they're having in trying to localize funding in that they have this big picture strategy to localize, but at the end of the day, they have similar pressures like the European Commission, including not enough staff to really do it. So Adva or Bijan, I'd love to get your thoughts on sort of those two stories between the US and the EU. They're both in some ways sort of two sides of the same coin.
I think that USAID story was interesting. I mean, it's talking about, you know, some of the challenges around hiring and having enough contractors, especially to fulfill this new mission around localization, which will take more staff and more local staff. And that, you know, the processes are slow because of that. And I think it is that sometimes the objective and the reality don't exactly match. I think one of the things that also sort of stood out to me on that EU aid story is this, you know, acknowledgement that official development assistance, that aid has always been linked to foreign and security policy objectives. And that despite, you know, concerns about that from, you know, NGOs and civil society, I mean, I think that is, you know, a reality that we've seen as someone who's also covers Congress quite closely here in the U.S., I think there has been in recent years actually a push even among the advocacy community to tie these aid discussions very clearly and very closely to national security and foreign policy objectives, and in part as a way to, you know, change that messaging and get the messaging right. But one interesting piece about sort of the way that, you know, I mean, some of these objectives I think could actually align with what African nations want, right? It's just about, you know, I do think they want an economic focused relationship that is about, you know, building markets and creating jobs locally and things like that, but it's about the execution. And I think Vince talks about that in his story. And I don't think that a lot of the major aid players have quite figured out how to balance sort of some of their objectives that they want and then the sort of operational realities and also political realities.
Just quickly, you know, on this point about civil society groups and NGOs who have long worried that there could be this strong connection between foreign policy objectives, economic objectives, and aid, I think the reason they've worried about that is they're worried that aid becomes this transactional tool that's used in the very short run to do things like secure alliances or win votes at the UN, which is a lot of what we saw during the Cold War, right? Like the Cold War was really good for total amounts of aid spending, but it was really bad for aid effectiveness because so much of it was spent in this way, in this very transactional way, to just win allies. And I think the nuanced argument that aid advocates today are making is, look, we can connect these funding flows directly to things like migration, directly to national security objectives, so long as we're connecting them to effective approaches that are long-term, that actually solve these problems. And they're not just used as kind of a Cold War tool, given the current geopolitical competition with China and with Russia. So I think that's the nuance today that people are trying to capture in this space. But Bijan, I'd love your thoughts on these stories too.
You can't see this, but I have a book lying next to me here on the desk here. It's by John Norris. It's The Enduring Struggle. It's the history of U.S. aid. Maybe something for your book club down the line, but it's amazing if you read how political incentives and politicization have messed up aid over the past decades. I mean, it's basically runs through the history of USAID and, of course, through other organizations. It just isn't very advisable to do it because of the impacts, as you mentioned. And I think the other thing is, if we think about, I wanted to connect to the Global Beat event as well and give some good news, at least one example on the EU side, right? So recently, the EU opened a talent pool, and I think it's been underreported. Last November, it was launched by the Commission, a talent pool for non-EU workers. Almost, they mentioned it as a Tinder for jobs. I actually think these things deserve more coverage because they're going in the right directions, and there are parliamentarians in the EU Parliament who are really pushing for this because they see the demand for skills and for workers that can't even be captured within the EU. So combining these two conversations maybe is a good framing for us going forward. On the localization piece, you know, I have very passionate views. I think we need to be really careful if people outside of DC read these articles about USAID, and basically the message is, we can't succeed in localization unless we hire more government workers. I think we are in the very wrong framing here, and we need to look at different solutions to this. There are some out there. It'd be great to discuss some ideas.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, right? Because we have been hearing this argument for many years now, that USAID is simply understaffed, and so there's no way to move to many smaller contracts with the same staff size. But actually, we do have to think about innovation and new models. And, you know, can there be new kinds of intermediary organizations that can take larger sums from USAID and then on-grant them to small local organizations in the form of micro-grants even, but do it with a very low overhead, with a very low transaction cost, and provide that layer of compliance and project management that USAID is, of course, interested in, but in some way that sort of disrupts the current model of contracts and grants going to kind of large global international organizations that then on grant a very small portion to local groups. So I do agree with you. There has to be more of a discussion about innovative approaches, because otherwise we're going to be stuck here, right? It does not seem likely. I mean, Adva, you might have a view to this, but it doesn't seem likely, even though there have been some real recent successes last week in the funding bills for Ukraine and Israel and the North Pacific and also for humanitarian aid that got through the Congress. Like, it doesn't seem likely USAID is ever in the near term going to achieve its requests around staffing.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about a lot more money in aid budgets, I think that's probably unlikely in the short to medium term. It just seems like it. You know, I mean, I think it's a real challenge, right? Because while we, you know, USAID did get some much needed humanitarian money in that bill, the base funding, you know, there is this reliance on these emergency bills, and the base funding is not sort of keeping pace. I did want to point one thing out in that story, which is that one of the things that USAID has done is made it possible for more foreign service nationals to be able to do contracting jobs. That is something that I think historically hasn't always happened, but I think that's one way you want someone who understands the local environment, who might not be in Washington, but might be in the country office to help work with some of these smaller organizations. I think that's one thing that USAID could look at doing more, right? And I think there's, you know, historically been questions about whether Foreign Service nationals should have the authority to, for example, sign off on spending and things like that. But I think that's one piece of it when you talk about innovation that the agency could be looking at. But from a you know, big picture funding perspective, I think it's going to continue to be a challenging fight in Congress.
Yeah, that's a great point. That is a kind of an innovation, right? They went from 19 Foreign Service nationals who have these so-called administrative warrants, which allows them to perform these kind of contracting roles, up to 48. So it's a big, you know, numerical percentage increase, but it's still probably very small compared to what's required. You know, what I'm hearing, and I'm here at this conference, as I mentioned, at Harvard's Kennedy School, and there are people from like 30 plus countries, many in the global south. And essentially what you hear, a constant refrain around localization, is, look, there are fantastic local leaders. There are impressive local organizations, but they have no access to this world of USAID and the European Commission and the big foundations. And they're not looking for millions of dollars. They're looking for small micro grants. $50,000 can go a long way in a small local community. How do we actually bridge that gap? And I think that's the kind of innovation that's going to be required. And it seems to be pretty universally felt that this is the problem, but the solutions are not easy to come by.
If I can add to this, so first of all, funny coincidence, when I read the localization article on the DevEx website, the ad on the page is by the American development companies, which are the lobbying arms of the so-called Beltway bandits. So I think it tells you something about the debate we need to have. The other point is, I think there are solutions out there. So think about it. We need a transformation of this sector, right? And we agree that the current aid model will not survive. What if we took a talent and people lens to this? Raj, you mentioned, right? There is talent out there, and I've worked with them. I engage with them in Atlas Core and other organizations. What if the requirement for many of these large INGOs and contractors were, show me within a period of 5 years how all the local partners you work with are able to apply themselves and make that part of the contracting? You know, you have a sunset clause of money that we want to give to local organizations and build their capacity, and that becomes part of a contract. I don't see why there aren't ways to do this if there is the political will. And interestingly, you see some of that political will even in the Heritage Foundation big report around localization. I found it really interesting that even on the conservative side, they say we need to move away from these big contractors and focus more on local.
And you know what's fascinating to me, Bijan, is that a lot of these big contractors, including the ones that you talk about having an ad on our site, and a lot of the big international NGOs, like the ones you used to work at, interestingly enough, when you talk to the executives there, they're arguing against their own financial interest, right? Because a lot of these are people who got into this field for the very same reasons maybe all of us did. They care about global development issues. They want to see these initiatives actually work. And so they're as much in search of a new model as anyone else. And it's a fascinating thing. Like, I've sat in these rooms with leaders of big international organizations who are saying, please don't count us as local. You know, we have a local affiliate. It's all local staff. Don't count us. We don't want that money because we're not truly local enough. And so I think the debate has actually shifted in a way that, you know, a decade ago, people were talking about localization, but they were still mostly arguing for their own interests. I don't know how the two of you feel about that, but I think there's a different moment today.
I think that's true among some organizations, but probably not all. And I think, you know, I wonder also if some are, you know, saying certain things publicly. And, you know, I don't know, I'm a journalist, I'm a skeptic. So are they really advocating against their self-interest, or are they still trying? You know, I think there are some who wouldn't mind still getting a lot of these flows of money. So.
Oh, that's for sure. But I guess the question is, can you still be a profitable, successful business if you're a for-profit contractor under a new model? And I think for these agencies to succeed, just like other, you know, government agencies, you know, have their own contracting issues and procurement issues, they need to find a way to incentivize localization, right? To make it in the interest of these contractors to do it. Not an easy thing given the other, you know, side of the equation, which is compliance and the requirement to ensure no dollar goes wasted, and we know where every penny was spent. But I think if we can find a way to create a market dynamic that incents localization, a lot of these organizations seem ready to go in that direction.
I agree with you. You had my colleague and former Save the Children colleague, Yolanda Wright, from GiveDirectly. I think there's also a conversation about the aid model that is more closely directly to people, rather than talking about intermediaries changing from one place to the other. How do we engage young people and recipients and partners directly through cash delivery, through apps. I'm working with a few really exciting organizations that reach youth directly. You can do a lot of things now, given all the stuff that is out there on Gen AI, on remote work. This is a really exciting time for development. And I do think those bigger organizations desperately need bigger and better visions for what their role is going forward, given all this innovation, because we shouldn't miss it.
No, that's absolutely right. We've kind of run out of time here, but I do want to alert our listeners to an important story that we may not have time to get into too much today, but from our colleague, Colm Lynch, who wrote a big exclusive about a couple of documents he got his hands on from within the USAID and the State Department that directly relate to the U.S. government's ability to sell military equipment to Israel. And it's related to directives around whether or not Israel is seen as violating international humanitarian law. And this memo that he unearthed and has now been covered by lots of other publications really talks about how experts inside USAID concluded that actually they are not in compliance with international humanitarian law, and that could impede the delivery of these kinds of assistances. So it's a really fascinating story, an important one to look at. I don't know if either of you had a chance to look at that. We just have maybe another minute left to discuss.
It's fascinating. And it reminded me of the 71 blood telegram that challenged from USAID staff that challenged the invasion of Pakistan in West Bengal. Really interesting parallels, except for Kissinger shut it down. It completely remained silent. And now we are in a very different environment. I think it's really important to hold our governments to the norms that they've set themselves.
Yeah, and the paper also mentions that, you know, there is an imminent inevitable famine, I think was the quote from one of these papers that he unearthed. And so it's really a shocking set of documents to have a look at. And I agree, it's taken on a lot of attention in the space. If you haven't had a chance to look at this piece, please do. And so much other reporting that we frankly have not had time to get into in this week's episode of This Week in Global Development. But it's been great to be with you, Adva and Bijan. Thanks for taking the time for the discussion.
Thanks, Raj.
Thank you very much.
This has been This Week in Global Development. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe using the link in the description. To get even more coverage and analysis on the most pressing development issues of the day, become a DevEx Pro member by going to devx.com/membership and signing up. Thank you for listening, and see you next week.